Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. My name is Bruce Perham. I'm a counsellor who has provided counselling and training to correction officers and frontline responders for over 15 years. In this series, I will be interviewing a wide range of psychologists who work in the trauma field, key stakeholders in the emergency sector, and frontline workers who have experienced mental health and at times trauma reactions due to the field in which they work. Hi, it's Bruce Perham here. Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. Today, my guest is Timothea Goddard, that will now be Tim. And Tim is a psychotherapist and a certified mindfulness teacher from Open Ground. Welcome, Tim. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bruce. Great to be here.
Now, maybe if you could just tell me a little bit about your own history in the field and when you first came across mindfulness as a way of working with people.
Yeah, I first started meditating in my early 20s, and I sort of happened upon a 10-day, very demanding Vipassana retreat and went along to that, and it was very demanding. But I learned a lot of things about myself. I was quite an anxious person, and I really found out about how not to rev myself up and how to kind of tolerate anxiety and let it kind of wash through me rather than, exacerbating it in a way. And I went on and did more retreats, and later on in my late 20s, I started training as a psychotherapist, and I became very interested in the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who had generated a course that really translates a lot of that learning from Buddhist psychology into a method that's kind of short enough for people, secular, and so lots of people will do it no matter what their kind of religious orientation, and also demanding enough to make a change in people's lives. And I sort of fell in love with that program and have committed the last 20 years really investigating it and teaching it and researching it, and it's just been amazing to see the power of it for people from all walks of life, and including people with trauma, interestingly enough, which is, yeah.
So how did you find, as you learnt more about it and started to incorporate it into your own life, what sorts of differences did it make for you in terms of, you know, you mentioned that managing the anxiety. How did it sort of help you with that?
Yeah, so I think about this question, certainly for me personally, but also in general, that there's three kind of ways that mindfulness training can help, a mindfulness practice can help. And one is, it's a training in attention. So, you know, we all know how to pay attention, right? We've been taught that from, you know, four years old in school, we're told to pay attention. And this is a kind of different training of our attention. So, for example, with anxiety, you might find, I think Mark Twain said this brilliant thing. He said, you know, some terrible things have happened in my life. I've experienced some terrible things in my life, and some of them actually happened. So with anxiety, so often our attention is focused on narratives and stories and imaginings about the future, and sometimes ruminations about the past, that are actually happening in our own head. And they are frightening, they are kind of preparing us to kind of meet a difficult situation. But we can actually have that going on moment by moment in our minds when it's actually not happening in this moment, right? So when we train up our attention, we start getting much quicker and more able to recognize that and make a choice about where we place our attention. So rather than being caught up in those narratives and frightening expectations, we can actually attune and help the body know, in this moment it's safe. In this moment I don't have any challenges. And that's profound.
Yes, well, as you were describing it, it's almost like having a tool or a process of intervention in the thoughts. I could let my thoughts run or I can intervene. Is that an accurate?
Yeah, and most of the time we don't even recognise that we have that narrative going. So for some people it's just amazing to actually start recognising, wow, that's a way of thinking that actually constructs how I feel in the moment. And to start recognising it, oh, that's a cognitive event. It's a mental event that I'm having, that I'm practicing. I'm practicing anxiety. And once you know that you're practicing something, you can actually start practicing something else. And you might be able to shift your attention, for example, from being so involved in that story to the visual field right now, being able to be present to your child or your partner or the work you've got to do. So it's very powerful in terms of if you're present to something, you can actually contribute, engage, learn. If you're not, if you're in some other narrative, you can't actually impact the present moment and give and contribute.
So in a way, you know, often when I sit with correction officers or police officers and they'll talk to me about their anxiety symptoms and often have really, really limited understanding of what's happening. So I don't know what this shit is I've got no idea, and I sit in the car before I go into work and I'm shaking like a leaf and I feel like, you know, vomiting. And I often feel then I, you know, start sort of having conversations around what anxiety is. It's a massive learning curve for people that have maybe lived with it or experiencing it that don't really have a great idea or knowledge about, well, what is actually happening to them. Mm-hmm. In your work, is that sort of, in a way, for some people, the beginning of encouraging them to recognise what their thought processes are or and connecting that to the anxiety?
Yeah, and I think two things have to happen at the same time. Like, information can be given about this is how bodies actually work when they're under massive stress. And a lot of these people you're speaking to live in a really threatening workplace. It's dangerous. It's difficult. It's emotionally challenging. And it's natural for a mammal, when it's often in that kind of situation, to be in the threat response. So some information about how bodies and minds work is really important. And to also go, like, you're not insane. This is natural and good. This is your threat response. And we're going to learn something about how to, through attention and through how you pay attention, to actually start regulating. I mean, one of the things that happens in a sustained mindfulness practice, like over 8 weeks where people are practicing every day, physiological arousal, it regulates. It actually, we calm our farm and the nervous system becomes more balanced in and of itself, no matter what narratives you're running or whatever. If you practice every day, your nervous system is going to move from high threat, high arousal, high demand to a more spacious, gathered, aware place that's not so reactive. That's just something that happens out of the training that people report over and over. So that's brilliant. But the psychoeducation is really important too, that this is normal and natural. The other thing that is really important in any mindfulness training or any good health, I suppose, if you're in that state, is to start getting to know your emotions and listening to them. And how to accept, first of all, that I am afraid or I am enraged right now because I'm in this very difficult situation, and how to explore them and how to calm down from them. We often, I'll just demonstrate a little process we often offer people, especially when they're anybody really, but especially if there's high arousal in the system, a lot of fear, anger, irritation, is to imagine that all of that feeling could be put into this fist. And normally when we're in that kind of arousal, the thing we do with it is, I shouldn't be feeling like that. Stop it. Calm down. God, I can't even do my job if I'm feeling so shaking and nearly feeling like I'm going to vomit and I'm terrified or I'm angry. We just want it to buck up. We want it to go away. So we have this attitude of kind of criticism. And what actually our emotions need and our physiological state needs when it's in threat is this kind of care. It needs to be supported, held. So mindfulness training, in a way, is making a relationship and of support and care for your emotional life. And if something can be offered time and space and presence, just like a little kid has strong feelings, we don't want to tell that kid, get out of the door, bugger off, I'm not interested in you. You welcome it onto your lap and say, hey, you know, something big's going on for you. I'm going to be here for you and be present and open and kind. And that's what the mindfulness is, actually. It's offering that to our emotions. And what we find is, oh, that emotion can actually, when it feels supported and understood and listened to, it can actually release and calm down and not be dominating, not be flooding. Does that make sense?
Oh, look, it does. Absolutely, totally, Tim. And I was just thinking as you were talking that often people describe at those times of high stress or post-incident, you know, in those environments, they often express that they didn't feel held or they didn't feel, you know, maybe on one level, you know, there's a lot happening and people are brought in and out, and so that it looks like, you know, there is a lot of support, and there is a lot of support, but a lot of people still say they didn't really kind of feel emotionally held.
Yeah.
And that connects with what you're saying, that that conversation of let's just sit down, let's talk it through in a way that you're free to share what you experienced often just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and
there'll be the dishing out.
Exactly. And that's your work, isn't it? Like really trying to make context where that can happen more. And this is really important in mindfulness training. Like it's not a solitary pursuit. I think the group is so powerful. We've just done quite a bit of work with veterans. And although one does the practice at home by yourself, coming together in a group where everybody's sharing their experience is so important, because we're not alone, we're not crazy. These responses we're having are normal and natural for humans. And to actually hear other people's journey and create a context that is respectful, open and responsive is often what people don't have in the context that, of the. And that's a huge question, isn't it, about how we operate these
and look,
workplaces.
It's one of the well, from my own point of view, where you know psychology is really a bit at loggerheads in terms of within EAP programs. You know, it's very much psychological first aid. You know, when you go out to do those sort of groups, that you stay, you know, in a way almost stay away from the trauma,
yeah.
Which is very contrary to a bit like what you were saying, my own direct experience where people really value that, you know, gee, I didn't know that, you know, Ted was having the same problems I'm having or was having the same visions or, you know, it's very normalizing. And so I agree with you totally. I think sometimes in a group, a lot more can come of it in that normalizing of the experience.
Exactly. And we are doing something radical in mindfulness training. It's because we're actually making space and time. And I think the context is really important. It has to be really well set up and people have to choose to opt into it. But we are saying this unpleasant experience you're having can be helped. And the first step of that is to turn towards it rather than away. And it's very adaptive for humans to go, I don't want to feel that. I'm going to distract myself with eating, drinking, TV, exercise. I don't want to pay attention to that emotional shite. I don't know how to deal with it. It's unpleasant and it makes me feel vulnerable and weak. I don't want a bar of it. But if in a group we're creating a context in which it's value-laden, it's of value, and people start their values about bravery, courage, you know, it's a brave thing to front up to your emotional life and attend to it skillfully and enable it to come down. And once people in a group start having that experience, enormous courage comes forth, and this inner experience that's felt so toxic suddenly becomes oh, I know how to help that. And it doesn't mean you're cast out, that you've got shame about, not being a good enough corrections officer, not being a good enough policeman or policewoman because I'm frightened, or these things become, oh yeah, I know how to look after that.
So what sort of response have you had from the veterans that you've been able to do the mindful training this with? What sorts of, because I'd imagine they come in not knowing a lot about the experience. I mean, yeah, what sort of...
Exactly. So it's a big cultural shift for people who've never done this before. And a lot of people come in with, oh, that touchy-feely stuff, what a lot of crap. These are some quotes from... a study that we did. We did about 7 groups with veterans all over Australia. And so one person said, I've been able to become more open and verbal with my partner about my emotional state. So this is the emotional intelligence, right? Rather than emotions being this thing that's just overwhelming, I can name what's happening. It's a process. Someone said, I'm calmer, I'm slower, much slower to anger. I pause before almost anything. I give better hearing and listening to my kids and my mum. It's interesting. Someone said, I've learnt to read my body's reactions and not be so reactive. My response to the kids' behaviour is far more positive, then having a much calmer flow-on effect. However, when grief takes hold, I let it run its course, crying but not losing my shit. So this is the regulation thing, being able to tolerate stuff but not being overwhelmed by it. The other thing people have said too, which is really important, is because people stop either drowning in emotional stuff or blocking it, there's 2 ways that are adaptive to deal with overwhelming states. One is to kind of block it, and one is to kind of collapse into it. And once people start being able to not do either of those but be more present and feel it and open up to a process of digestion, they start initially, it's like, oh, wow, they start seeing their difficulties more clearly and seeing, and that can feel challenging. But by then they've got some resources to actually start processing some of these and really letting the traumatic experiences start to be able to be in the past, to have because it's about something not being listened to and not being digested. If an emotional response like fear or anger keeps coming up, it's about something not having been able to be processed. And I think good psychotherapy and good mindfulness training really gives an opportunity for that to be literally digested, so it can be gotten rid of. And then you're present more to the next moment in your life. You're not carrying all these reactivities in that are kind of automatic in your body physiologically.
Yeah, look, it's so interesting, Tim, because often, my sense of the context that people, particularly, I can talk directly about correction officers and police officers, go into this work with, and historically have certainly gone into this work with, that a bottling up is the way to go.
Yes,
you have the event, as you said, you go home, down a 6-pack and, front up for work the next day and get back on the horse, yep, get back straight into it, yep, roll on with it. Which is certainly not, it doesn't give people an opportunity to really, it's come in, make a difference, change people's lives, make the community safe, rehabilitate prisoners. There's often very little about what tools you might need to be able to personally survive it.
Exactly. It's and so demanding, these jobs.
And do you find then that it's almost like the horse is halfway down the track, that the sorts of things that you teach it at those groups, if we could teach people at the beginning, because I often think that, if you promoted reality of the job, no one would apply for it.
Yeah.
But if you actually promoted the reality of the job, but there's lots of things we can do to support you through it, that would be unbelievably valuable for people to go, okay, I need to connect with the emotion of the experience.
Exactly. And also people need to be, I agree with you. And I think there's been some interesting work in the US with an 8-week mindfulness course being offered as part of military training before people are deployed. And that has shown really good evidence of people coming back with less PTSD. They've actually given tools to and methods and processes to attend moment by moment as they go through those very difficult experiences. I mean, deep bow to those people who do those jobs. Wow. They're not given good information about what it might mean for the rest of their lives. You know, trauma can really change lives, can't it? If it's
and the focus on the you know, the sort of the training is, well, we've got to train you to do the job, and that makes sense. You do, but then the deficiencies in, but we'll also teach you how to psychologically deal with it. And you know, I can only talk about what I see, but that's where the gap is. And and is there much research going into like that research of, if we actually provide this training to people at the beginning, that we can see differences? Because to me, that's the whole. That's where attention should be. What do we need to provide these people before they go into these?
Yeah, so the damage occupations. Isn't done. And there's more resilience. And what is that? Yeah. And I think it does. I mean, I think the power of some process of mindfulness, I think it's really important that these things aren't shunted off onto the individual. It's your responsibility not to be hurt by this environment, because if you were stronger, tougher, more able to process, you know, you'd be fine. I think what you're pointing to is really owning the organisation, owning that this is a very demanding job and all humans are going to respond how people respond, and how do we as a group support each other. So I think it really involves a cultural shift, doesn't it, in the organisation. If you introduce the training early on, I mean, you're probably really across this. I mean, but unless
well, I
you
absolutely
have,
100%, yeah, you know, agree.
Unless you have that, though, unless you have that, people are, and I think most, you know, what you were saying about, you know, have the traumatic event, go home, down a six pack, get back on the horse, is a model of, it's a cultural model of how you deal with emotions. What if you had a context where it was okay for some vulnerability, for some, you know, and that was normal, and knowing that what we need to handle that is not just to be more, you know, individually resilient, because I think a lot of stuff gets pushed onto the individual. If only you were stronger, tougher, wiser, then you could do it. But this context is really powerfully threatening. Difficult for the prisoners, difficult for the corrections officer, difficult for the police. I mean, it's such an intense, traumatic situation. And to do that every day is really demanding. And so to have I love the power of the mindfulness thing, I think, is in the group. Like what I was saying before, of people getting together to hear these veterans talk about their experience and open to each other with kindness, respect, care, even though someone's crying or raging or talking about with shame about how they treated their partner that week. And just to go, everyone around the room going, I know how you feel. That person is then not aligned with those feelings. It's like the whole group's doing that holding, right?
Yes.
I think there's so much emphasis on the individual toughness. I just don't think that's how we work as mammals.
it just seems to set off long-term behavioural changes that people. You know, and I've had so many officers say, police and correction officers say, you know, a family member said to them, you're different, or, you know, you don't pat the dog anymore, or you don't play with the kids anymore. There seems to be this process of change over time that people aren't aware of, or maybe marginally aware of. And so I totally connect the idea of, well, culturally we need to change, and there needs to be more transparency about, well, if you're going to be a correction officer, if you're going to be a police officer, if you're going to be a fiery, if you're going to be a paramedic, you will be exposed to significant trauma events. and having conversations with people like yourself, but there is help there. There are things that you can do that will put you in a better position to deal with it.
And that's what's missing. Yeah, and it's interesting the examples you use then, Bruce, because that's our experience in MBSR generally, like the mindfulness program I run, generally, even with corporates, you know, corporate organisations want people to do mindfulness to make them more concentrated and efficient and more productive. But the overarching responses from people is, I'm nicer to my dog, I'm nicer to my kid, I listen to my husband more. Like, amazing. And same with the veterans. And that's what people care about, I think. And we are learning to treat ourselves with more respect, generosity, care. And that if that gets ebbed away in your life without even being aware of it, that's the quality of your life, isn't it? The quality of our relationships is so important. And to have that degraded by a job is just so painful for people. And they find themselves absolutely lost and alone and getting divorced and not having a connection with their kids. And
you know, and I think I think maybe there has been some research done with police. I don't think there's been any done with correction officers. But, you know, I think they rate high on all of that in terms of marital breakdowns, PTSD, alcohol consumption. And as you said, I really relate to that it all goes back to the individual. Well, you actually need to look after yourself. Well, how do I do that? what do I do now when I'm already starting to experience, you know, the longer term impacts of what's happening to me? And that's why I often have the sense of rear guard action for people like me of, okay, well, we, you know, what can you do now when you're looking at ways of trying to shift? Now, another question, I ramble on, and I think listeners will learn that by now. In terms of the trauma memories, because what does the mindfulness do that allows people to not be so overcome by what's coming back to them?
Yep, that's a really important question. And there's a lot of important, there's been a real flurry in the last 5 years about trauma-sensitive mindfulness. Making mindfulness safe and for people to, because in the olden days it was sort of a thing, well, the olden days, you know, 20 years ago, it was considered if you had PTSD, doing an 8-week mindfulness course wasn't the best course of action for you. But now we're seeing the program used for veterans, for people who've suffered sexual abuse, domestic violence, for police, for the military. So interesting, huh, that it's shifted. And I think if it's people are offered in the training, people are offered a map and a method to start digesting benign experiences and knowing them, which is brilliant. Opening up to the pleasant in your life is just as important as processing the difficult and even these traumatic memories. So there's a real emphasis on getting familiar with, that's a thought, that's an emotion. I know emotions because of how they felt in the body. This is my physiological state. So one thing I mentioned before the training does, it basically down-regulates the whole nervous system, so you're in a better position to be able to pay attention to difficult states. And how do I describe it? It's people are taught to, in a titrated way, step by step, start opening, dipping your toe in to an unpleasant experience and then feeling it in a way that your awareness can keep holding it, like that metaphor I used. So rather than the fifth just exploding everything, people are really invited. And and one of the main methods of this is through really paying attention to the body. So one of the things we do in the course actually is ask people to open to something that's bugging them. It could be one of these difficult memories that keep coming back and flooding. It could be a fight you had with your partner, or it could be being frightened to go into work the next day after a difficult event. So it could be, you know, anything, so, right? And so people are invited to invite that experience in right now, bring it to mind if you like. And we use writing quite a bit in doing this. So write down what you are aware of in terms of the thoughts of that situation. Where is the, what emotion is it? And where do you know that emotion in the body? And the training is over time really allows people to discern where that experience is in the body and notice that it's changing. And if you are able to train your attention in a way that you can pay attention to unpleasant experience in the body, quite quickly the arousal abates. It becomes less. Now, this is people often don't stick around long enough. They move into the six-pack or the TV or the distraction, the shutting off, to know that if you can tolerate, and we're training people up bit by bit to tolerate, you know, you don't want to leap straight into the big traumatic memory, but by just tolerating ordinary boredom, irritation, you know, being flustered, you know, in a new situation, feeling a bit embarrassed, whatever. Like, so it's really titrated, but being able to tolerate those things and hold them in awareness with what we call equanimity. Now, equanimity is a big word, and probably, you know, many people don't know what that word means, but it means with more emotional balance, less reactivity. So my example from anxiety when I was 20 and went to that, you know, meditation retreat, I learned that I could have a real flurry of fear about a future event, and I'd be sitting there, and if I brought my attention to the unpleasant body sensations, sweat, heat, heart thumping, guts feeling like they were going to drop out of me, like quite strong anxiety stuff I had, and I waited and I got very curious with that heart thumping or that quality of heat and sweat or exactly where was that guts churn going on, exactly where was it in my solar plexus or pelvis or stomach. If you can stay present, even for 3 minutes, what you know, without reacting, without going, ah, this is catastrophe, I'm going to die, that's the window, right? You're training, you're increasing the window of tolerance to an unpleasant event. And if you can hang there with this curiosity, it's very hard to be curious about fear and anger and rage, right? Mm. But that's what we're very slowly training people up to do. Curiosity and fear, it changes the fear if you're curious about it. It's saying to the whole nervous system, this is nothing to be afraid of. You can actually pay attention to it and know it in a different way. And the nervous system goes, but don't I have to run away from that tiger right now? No, that's just a thought going on in your head. Look around. There's no tiger. Like that's kind of the process of and we'll do after this, at the end of the session, hey, we'll do a little orientation practice, which will give people a bit of a taste of this process, maybe.
And look, Tim, what you're talking about in terms of people that are constantly exposed to trauma and being re-traumatized, I can just see that element of I'm fearful, even though people might not articulate that, but the body does. Yep. You know, I often have these awkward saying, sort of, well, yep, your body will tell you, you know, I come out with these pretty simplistic, you know, the brain will let you know, the brain will keep letting you know. But, you know, in a way that kind of, okay, you've had the incident, you've had the trauma incident at work, but to then have those sorts of capacities and skills to be able to then work on lowering the fear the next time you go back to work or to, you know, there's very little that happens in that space. You know, trying to wrap, you know, trying to support people and, you know, trying to get them back to work. But, you know, even for someone like me that works in the industry, you know, it's complex stuff that,
yes,
you know, that when people have been taught to not do any of that, you know, don't Don't do any of that. You don't need to touch it.
Oh, yeah.
And now I'm really interested in originally when the psychological thinking was that it wasn't good to have people in groups. Was that for a fear of triggering their PTSD, or what was the theories at the time that was, you know, you shouldn't do that?
Yeah, I think in the mindfulness groups.
There was reluctance to do that.
That's right. So I think it was just, I think it was not even in groups, but to do any mindfulness training, that it would be triggering or something. Now there's good evidence that people can be trained to look after their waves of emotion and use this method to calm down and digest. But that was the idea and it just wasn't research, basically.
No, and so there's more, there's an acceptance of, well, in actual fact, touching it's not a bad thing, and that we can do that in the safety of a group.
Exactly, yeah. And with the skills, with the titrated skills built up over time.
I'd imagine that that's a trailblazing aspect of the work in a way, because historically no one's ever thought to do it.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of what I'm struck with, we're talking about groups of people who are in a workplace where this is going to be the norm, right?
Mm.
This is going to be the bread and butter of their lives, that this is going to be something that they kind of need to learn how to process and digest on a regular basis. But also, I'm also struck by when you run ordinary groups, ordinary, you know, we work in Australia, ordinary Australians coming, people it's kind of powerful for everybody to learn how to process difficult emotions. And lots of people have had all kinds of traumas, being in a car accident when you're five and a parent dying, or, you know, like people, it's just, yeah, or being in a fight when you're 18, or, you know, people have a lot of stuff going on and a lot of things that feel out of their control. And it's very powerful to start cultivating the confidence to at least be able to have some more say and control over your own patch of this body, this mind, these feelings, to actually know it a bit better and have a map.
Yeah.
And to not, when there's mess, it's not a problem. It's just, oh, I'm feeling a bit messy because of course I am, because this has just upset me and I'm going to deal with it. So people get more confidence about attending to their ongoing flow of life.
Really. And I guess it's sort of gently connecting with those past experiences. They are yours. Yep. They are in your body. And, you know, is that partly where people really start to respond, to start to think, I don't need to be so afraid of what's in my head?
Exactly. What's in my head? What's in my body? Like, yeah. And it's a lot of mindfulness. Like, it can sound a bit touchy-feely, but what if we treated, I used the metaphor earlier today, but what if we treated our emotional distress not as a problem, but as just something that needs our care? Something that needs our care. What a radical shift that is. So we, instead of distracting from it, pushing it away, it being shame-laden, what if we said, welcome, God, come here. Come and join this community that's me, all the different parts of me, and you can belong here and get calm, you can get soothed, you can get help, you can have care to calm down from those states. They don't have to define you. They're just an ordinary reaction, a healthy ordinary reaction, the threat response. But come in. Like, not, it's like, think if we have a front door and a back door, and most people live, I think, with the front door and the back door barred. I can't let any bad emotions in, messy emotions in. But what in mindfulness training, we're really opening up a different way of being, which is, yeah, if I'm upset or feeling messy or overwhelmed, open the door, welcome. Give it a space to be known, supported, cared for, and then let it go out the back door. So what happens mostly is we barricade the front door. We're always fighting to shut things out by drinking, overeating, distracting, you know, shutting down our aliveness, shutting down our perceptual apparatus, our capacity to hear and see because we've heard and saw too much. So we're barricading the front door. When stuff gets in, as it does, then we don't open the back door either. We don't know how to let things go, to really know that is in the past. And now, if I'm able to open my front door again, this is really profound, important part of the training too. It's not only about difficult experience. People are shut off from ordinary connectedness and relating and the goodness that might be in even having a shower. If you're in a traumatized state, even having a shower is not a time for restoration and pleasure and enjoyment. It's just you're in the shower thinking, oh, my God, how am I going to cope with that? Oh, my God, you're having the memories come flooding in. You've got the, you know, and, oh, no, I've got to, you know, or overwhelmed planning lists, to-do lists, where if our attention hasn't been trained, we're just flooded by the cacophony of demands and memories and in a really undisciplined way. So something that's pleasurable, taking a walk with the dog, having a shower, eating something delicious, having that first cup of coffee, you're not there for it. You're not there open, front door open, to receive all the beautiful tastes and sounds and, you know, the delight on your five-year-old's face when they're showing you a drawing. You're preoccupied with, oh, my God, I can't listen to that right now because I've got to, you know. And so the training is really asking people, and there's as much emphasis on the pleasurable as is there on the difficult in the course, because that is where life abides. And to up that capacity to know in all the ordinary, more mild moments of life that I'm going to be there for them and really savour them. That is restorative for the nervous system that's on high alert.
Mm. And so many people sort of say to me, I enjoy nothing, which is exactly. the ultimate impact of the work experience is so overtaken everything else.
Exactly. And that's devastating to have your goodness in your life drained away by a job. That's just heartbreaking.
I love that idea of, and it really fits with when you're working in a traumatized or an occupation that has the real potential to provide trauma to you of, well, yeah, okay, the door's open. I know that these experiences are going to happen and I know I'm going to be in the middle of them and I know I'm going to have to deal with it, but come in. I love that. Idea.
Exactly. Come in.
I don't have to have five blocks of wood across the door to stop you getting in, because I think that really hits the nail on the head of how people have been taught to deal with it. Lock it out.
Exactly. You know, and that's the tension, and, right? I've got to stop. I've got to shut it down. And shutting down is depressing.
And sort of a bit of that, if I actually let it out, I'll be swamped by it. So I've just got to keep locking it up. So, it just makes so much sense to.
And it works for a bit, right? It works for a bit, but it's not sustainable.
No.
Bodies and minds are not made to kind of hold that amount of tension.
And in some ways, my own sense of PTSD has been that that's the breaking point. That's where you're not able to hold it anymore because it's just too powerful.
Maybe
if you could just say a little bit about what training is available for people, you know, that if someone was watching, you know, or listening to our podcast, what's out there for them that, I'm sure there's a lot in terms of apps and online training and, you know, what's available to people if they really want to learn more about how to do that?
Yeah, so apps don't really go where we've gone today.
No.
Apps are a little bit, they're sort of still in the sort of wellness industry space, I think, where people use apps to get a little bit more relaxed and stuff, which is a great experience and does happen quite quickly. I think what's needed for this kind of demand, the kind of jobs we're talking about, is something more sustained. So, and I think the evidence lies in about an 8-week course
yes.
that is you know, has been researched for this. It's been tried out in all sorts of contexts now. And what that offers, paradoxically, well, firstly, it offers a teacher. And I think you do need a teacher, right? Like an app, you don't get a teacher. With mindfulness-based stress reduction, you get a teacher who you have an interview with them for 15, 20 minutes before you start the course to really hear, okay, what are the signals coming up in your mind, heart, body that you want to address? You get in good information about what this is going to involve in terms of time commitment, emotional commitment. You get a teacher and you get a relationship. So I think this is key. And you have an interview with that teacher before, you know, a meeting, usually on the phone or online like we're doing. And you get to talk. You get to say, okay, I'm having these symptoms. I don't like how I am with my kid. You know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And the teacher hears that and keeps it in mind, knows you a bit. And also you get good information about what the hell this course is going to demand of you, because it's bloody demanding. People are asked to meditate, you know, meditate, you learn how to do that. They're asked to do training exercises for 40 minutes a day. That's a lot. But if you're not watching TV to distract yourself, you actually got heaps. I often ask people, people say, I've got no time to do meditation. I say, how much TV do you watch? Oh, 3 hours a night. Oh, you've got heaps of time to meditate. No problem. So you get a good handle on the course, and already you're starting to make a relationship with someone who knows you a bit and knows what you're grappling with and knows the material. So the teacher can also say, God, you're going to hate the first part of this course. It's going to drive you mad. But bring it on. Welcome. Yes. Open the front door, right? And that's workable. So you're having a relationship with someone already. And the way the group is structured, it's so – it's hard to describe, but it's so respectful. Yeah, so there's a culture of care that is in like a well-taught 8-week course where from the – it's like there's a culture formed in the group of respect and it's – and care. And it's not touchy-feely. It's not – it's just – it's very – somehow about when we start really paying attention together purposefully in a group – and really seeing and hearing each other. And there's no pressure for people to share too. Yeah. It's like it's a very specific. Anyway, I can offer some – I'm the director of training for a mindfulness training institute that trains teachers. So I can give you a website where people could look up a teacher in their area.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. And we can put
– to go to an 8-week course.
Yeah.
And I also – I'm director of also of Open Ground that offers these 8-week courses all over Australia, but there's really good teachers who aren't part of Open Ground. So I'll offer both of those websites for people to check out if they want to do a course.
Oh, that
– it's really important to get a teacher-led course at least 8 weeks where you're quite demanded of in terms of the practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and look, I think a lot of the people I've met over the years are at the point that they would try to, you know, if there's anything they can do that may give them some relief from what they're living with. Now, quick question that popped into my mind. If someone is seeing a psychologist through a mental health care plan, my sense would be the mindfulness would work very well with that. As general psychological counselling, but then somebody's doing some my sense would be that would work beautifully together. Is that your sense?
It would really work beautifully. What we've found is it really enhances any therapy because people are getting such a rich map and their capacity for emotional regulation, physiological regulation is changed.
Yes.
So it really helps them do the one-on-one work for sure. It's like a beautiful dovetailing.
Yeah. No, that was my sense. And, we're going to now do a mindfulness experience with Tim. So over to you. And Martin and I here, we're ready to go.
Ready for internal action.
Yep.
Beautiful. So really pragmatic. This will give people a flavour of the ordinariness of it and the value of it, I hope. So we'll take about 7 minutes. Would that be all right?
Yep, that's okay. Yep. Is that okay for you?
Okay. Yeah, that's perfect. I just need a couple of minutes to shift the money.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just start with checking out the visual field. So wherever you're sitting, which if you're watching this video, you're going to be checking out me and Bruce and the screen. and with some deliberateness now, just checking out the room you're in and letting your head move. And so often in life where, you know, we stop actually noticing if we're in a familiar space, but really checking out this room as if you've never seen it before, the different colours, the shapes, the light. And one thing that this is offering us too is we're orienting to the fact that we're safe right now. We're not at work. In this moment, we're not being demanded of except to do this weird mindfulness business. So just taking that in, that these four walls are here, there's a floor underneath me, and just letting these eyes, so often when we do looking to, we sort of have our eyes out on stalks. We're so often having to be vigilant with our eyes. So just letting your eyes be kind of soft, receptive, rather than having to go out and grab the information. Let all the information, the colours, the shapes, the lights, just come to you. You don't have to go out and make anything happen with seeing. It can just all kind of fall towards you and just receiving the sights. And let's do the same with hearing. In this moment, opening to all the sounds that are arising and passing away. So there's my voice. Some sounds in your environment. You might hear a car going by or a dog barking or a bird. Being present to the comings and goings of your life right now. And noticing some sounds might be pleasant, like hearing a bird or the wind whistling. A leaf blower outside might be known as unpleasant. Cultivating this openness to whatever's here, noticing the unpleasant just as much as the pleasant, but really opening to the pleasant as well. So we're seeing and we're hearing with some openness and curiosity and spaciousness. And just noticing what you're tasting in your mouth. Just including those senses as well. What's happening right now? So maybe the residue of the cup of coffee you just drank or the taste of breakfast, dinner. That's all happening right now too, tasting and smelling. And now dropping into your body, just feeling the weight of your body sitting here, resting on the chair, or maybe you're lying down. Feeling the contact that your body's making with the environment. With gravity, you might feel a sense of pressure if you're sitting under buttocks and thighs and feet. Feeling into the idea that gravity could be your friend, it could actually invite you into a little bit of feeling the support underneath you. No need to hold up or hold back. Feeling into the contact of your clothing on your skin. No big deal, just the simple contact of clothing. Contact of air, this moment, being present to your whole body. And if we're contacting the air or feeling that contact of air, just noticing that you're breathing. You might want to take a fuller breath, feeling the movement in the body to accommodate that air, and then just letting a breath out, arriving. And similarly, as you open up to your body sitting here, you might notice unpleasant bits that feel tight or headachy or agitated, then there might be pleasant bits going on, places of calm and spaciousness and ease. Really good to notice. We often get hijacked by the unpleasant and don't notice all the bubblings of pleasantness in our bodies. And now just noticing the flow of your mind, whatever that is. But we can often recognize our kind of mind as thoughts, memories, images. Maybe a to-do list popped in. Random stuff might, a memory from watching a TV show last night. This is all the flow of our own mind. No problem. This is going to be an ordinary part of noticing when we start practicing mindfulness. And just noticing how we can recognize that and then shift back to feeling the whole body sitting here, breathing. And let's just finish there by acknowledging that we've just practiced some mindfulness, orienting to this present moment and really taking in the goodness that's here in this moment and also difficult bits. And we're learning how to have a balanced mind to be able to hold both of these things without so much reactivity. How do you feel, Bruce?
Oh, that was awesome. I think the thing I'd reflect is the how it does slow your thinking down, but it gives you, I don't know, it's a clarity of what you're actually thinking, whereas we all move so quickly that I'd suggest any listener to do it again because you know, and listen to this part again. And probably at times that you feel you need it to use it. Yeah, I thought it was great. Thank you so much, Tim. And a quick thought that I had, would you be interested to be interviewed again next year? And what I might, would you?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Fantastic. Now, for listeners, email in any questions that you have of Tim, for Tim about mindfulness, right. And I will ask Tim when we interview her again next year. And so it's an opportunity to find out more. If you've been interested, shoot your questions in and we'll talk to Tim again. See you, Tim. Bye.
Great. Beautiful. See ya.
As a final message for the year, I just wanted to share, my reactions to some of the interviews that I've been able to do. When you have an idea, you never really know how it will turn out or whether it will turn out at all. The idea of doing the podcast interviews came to me on a holiday mid-2022. When I returned, I set about making it happen. Firstly, I was buoyed by the very talented individuals who accepted my invitation to be interviewed on Trauma from the Front Line. A very close second goes to my cousin Ailsa for introducing me to Martin and his team at In-House Create in Footscray. With Martin taking on full responsibility for the quality of our recordings, I've been able to focus on the interviews. Finally, a big thank you to my guests who have shared their knowledge and expertise in such a relaxed and caring way. My aim has been to create resources for all frontline workers that will seek to demystify what counselling is and to provide clearer pathways as to what therapy models are available to them as they wrestle with the psychological challenges of frontline work. As they say, knowledge is power, and the more we understand the psychological responses that can come from doing frontline work, the more power we will have in controlling our own workplace destinies. I've learned a great deal from my guests and I have emerged more hopeful that there are some very positive things happening in this frontline space. We have a long way to go, but I'm a little bit more excited by where we may end up. Next year, we will change gears a little and I am keen to share the personal stories of people who have worked on the front line. If you would like to share your story on Trauma from the Front Line, send me an email at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au and I will be in touch. I would like to wish you all a very happy Christmas and New Year and be safe. Trauma from the Front Line will recommence on Monday, February 6th. Take care. Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you would like to get in touch with me, or if you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. It really helps the show grow and reach a larger audience. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636.